How much do you know about how our Constitution shapes our lives? What exactly did our founding fathers have in mind when they created that venerated document 225 years ago? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour of our program, we celebrate the Constitution's anniversary with historian David Wendell. We'll also talk with the mayor of Hampton, Iowa, organizer of the week-long Liberty Fest. Then in the second half hour, we'll discuss branding. We're not talking cattle. We'll find out why Simpson College just won the Battle of the Brands. That's all coming up after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. Now, those words and the rest of our Constitution are 225 years old. But I wonder, how much do you and I, how much do we, as citizens of these United States of America, know about how our Constitution shapes our lives? And what exactly did our founding fathers have in mind when they created this venerated document 225 years ago and signed it? Well, so I want to explore this first half hour. We'll start off with Iowa historian David Wendell, who is in our studio in Iowa City. David Wendell, welcome to our program.
Ben, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Great pleasure to have you. This past Sunday, you were coordinating, moderating an unusual and interesting event in Marion. It was a reenactment of the opening ceremonies that convened the Constitutional Convention 225 years ago in Philadelphia. Tell us what took place.
Well, George Washington served as president of the convention at Independence Hall, or what we would call Independence Hall today, then known as the State House in Philadelphia in 1787. He had not yet become president of the United States because we did not have a constitution to create a president. Therefore, he was simply president of the Constitutional Convention and not necessarily by his own wishes. At the same time in Philadelphia, there was a reunion, if you will, of military figures from the Society of the Cincinnati. And he was afraid that if he came to Philadelphia at the same time, it would give the appearance that we would have a military nation, meaning we would have a monarchy rather than a democracy. And it took a lot of, shall we say, arm twisting by other Virginians, such as James Madison and so forth, to get George Washington to serve as president of this Constitutional Convention.
And don't we have to remember the feeling about George Washington at him at that time? Many would have gladly accepted him as a lifelong president or king even.
Well, yes, he was offered to be the king. And when he was commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, he did something that even King George in England said, if this is true, he is the greatest man in history. And that was that George Washington voluntarily resigned as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, showing that he insisted we not have a monarchy in this country.
In this reenactment you had last Sunday, you had someone playing George Washington to deliver the dedication remarks, didn't you?
Right. We had George Washington reading the preamble and then reading the final article of the Constitution, which basically states that we who are gathered here representing the – and they only had 12 states represented. Rhode Island refused to send any delegates. We here representing these 12 states will sign our names pledging to this Constitution for the United States of America. And then I also had our guest, including Associate Justice Wiggins from the Iowa Supreme Court and Speaker Paulson, Speaker of the Iowa House Paulson, sign the Constitution along with everyone present. And this really brought it home to everyone there because now their name is on the Constitution.
What does that do when we have, and it sounds like a wonderful reenactment. I'm sorry I wasn't there to witness it, but tell me what you hope to accomplish, and I'm thinking did accomplish with a reenactment that you can't with a sort of a discussion. When you have someone play George Washington, when you have delegates, people playing the delegates, and you try to take yourself back to that time as much as possible, what does that accomplish that another message can't?
Well, I would suggest it's kind of like reading a book. I brought you a copy of the Constitution, if you so choose to read today.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And we distributed those to everyone who came to the event. Now, you can read the Constitution, and that's great and wonderful, and I hope everyone does. But that does not give you an idea as to how brave and outstanding the men who gathered in Philadelphia were to create it. And what I mean by that is each and every one of them took an incredible risk, an incredible chance on compromising their principles in order to achieve a document that would satisfy everyone.
Wait a minute. Compromises way back in the end of the 18th century? I thought that was an I thought our founding fathers didn't compromise. At least maybe sometimes you hear our political rhetoric and you think that doesn't happen. They were compromising.
Here we are in the 21st century, and we have a Congress that has adjourned until after the election, so more than a month away, and people are complaining that they have done nothing. Well, they say that Congress is not willing to compromise. Well, let's go back to the founding fathers. Now, first of all, in 1787, just as today, our nation ranged everywhere from Massachusetts down to Florida. And that is quite a range both of topography and of professions. In the North, you were primarily industrial and trade. In the South, you were agricultural. So therefore, the things that were needed for the North and the things that were needed for the South were ever so slightly different. Mm. And therefore, in order to get all sides to come together and agree to sign a document for the betterment of everyone, compromises were made. Compromises were reached. I can't help
Like,
for example, there were those who felt that the president of the United States should be elected for life. In fact, there are those who felt that he shouldn't be elected. He should be chosen by Congress in a similar pattern to the way it's done in England and other countries with that type of a constitutional system. Also in that regard, once they decided that a president of the United States should serve for 4 years and then be up for reelection and so forth, the question became, well, what about this Congress? Should Congress members have the opportunity to serve for life, or, as was being hotly debated at the time, should they only serve for 1 year? And the reason for this was because it was feared that if they served for more than 1 year, that it could become like a monarchy, that they would gain too much power and our tripartite government would lose the system of checks and balances that they desired. So what I'm saying is that the folks from the North certainly had to compromise to appease the folks from the South. The folks from the South had to compromise to appease the folks from the North, because each of them were afraid that if in Congress, for example, you had all states represented by only two individuals, the North felt that they would not be equally represented for their dominant population. On the other hand, if you did it the other way, then the South felt that they'd benefit. So it really was a compromise that they reached between the two.
Now, one of the beauties of the Constitution that all recognize is that it allows for change through the amendments. How did that come about?
Well, the founding fathers were smart enough to realize that as time went on, circumstances would change, and therefore the document would probably need to change with it. And as a result, they decided that indeed we could add amendments to this Constitution. And I might add, those amendments are what actually allowed the Constitution to be signed on September the 17th, 1787, because so many of the delegates said, we will not sign this document, we will not support it unless it means a Bill of Rights. And those were the first 10 amendments. So giving the Constitution the ability to add amendments literally is what put it over the top for many of the delegates and made it possible to sign on September 17, 1787.
David Wendell with us, if you've just joined us, Iowa historian. We're celebrating the 225th anniversary of the signing of the U.S. Constitution, talking a little bit about what it makes it special, the historical context in which it was created. I wonder, with that thought, what you just said in mind, what do you suppose, as someone who is intimate with the Constitution, if I can say that, and a historian, that suppose that our founding fathers would make of the discussion we have about the constitutional issues we face today? Would they say it's going exactly as we planned? The machinery we put in place is serving our republic as we envisioned?
I think actually we're debating the same issues today that they debated in 1787, just with a different impetus for it is all. As I mentioned before, you had two diametrically opposite fields of thought. One, predominantly from the North, was that we needed to have a strong central government in order for the country in general to survive, whereas the Southern states believed in states' rights, sovereignty, that each state had the right to govern itself rather than a stronger and dominant federal. And if you look at the topics being debated today and comparing, for example, the thoughts of Willard Romney or Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, I think you can find similar tones in the debate.
Historian David Wendell with us talking about the U.S. Constitution. Well, David, we might make a wager, and we might be correct in this wager, that no small town in America is celebrating the 225th anniversary of the signing of the American Constitution with more vigor than Hampton, Iowa, the Franklin County seat, about 4,500 residents in north central Iowa town. And this week they've been celebrating Liberty Fest the entire week. It's the brainchild of Hampton's libertarian mayor who was elected last fall, Sean Dietz. I hope that he is joining us by phone. Mayor Dietz, are you there? Okay, Mayor Dietz is not there. We'll organize him in just a moment. Let's talk a little bit more, David Wendell, about that. When we talk of the Constitution, there is there are two camps, if you want to be broad speaking terms, of people who believe that we have strict adherence, should have strict adherence to the Constitution, and others who say, no, this is a living document. There is wiggle room here. So how do we know how we should view this document as more rigid or more flexible?
Obviously, that's up to the individual to decide, and that's one of the reasons that I put the event together that I did this past Sunday. For not only did we conduct the reenactment, but I also invited, as I mentioned, Associate Justice Wiggins and Speaker of the House Paulson to come and speak, because I knew that generally they don't necessarily agree on all aspects of the Constitution and how to interpret it and so forth. And indeed, Mr. Paulson did say that he believes in a constructionist view of the Constitution, whereas Justice Wiggins suggested that indeed he believes it is a living document.
Is there any way to determine who is right, or are they both right?
Well, I would have to suggest that the very fact that we are allowed to amend the Constitution shows that it's a living document.
Okay. Let's go to Mayor Sean Dietz, mayor of Hampton, Iowa, and the initiator, organizer of Liberty Fest, now joining us by phone. Mayor Dietz, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. We have a few minutes remaining in this half hour. Tell us what's been going on this week during Liberty Fest.
Well, we started the week off. I signed the Constitution Week proclamation and had a little bit of fanfare with that, a nice photo op, and the proclamation just reminds our citizens of the importance of the document and the importance of that date in American history.
Mm-hmm.
Then we followed that up with we had a little bit of a reenactment of our own. One of our councilmen and somebody who's very involved in the arts and the community put together kind of a one-man or two-man show, I guess it was, and kind of told the story of the Constitutional Convention. And being in Franklin County, we, of course, had to have Benjamin Franklin be part of that.
There you go.
And then that followed up with a debate between Congressman Steve King and his Democratic challenger, Christy Vilsack. In the Windsor Theater there in Hampton, and the whole night was really great. I felt like it came off really well, and I felt both sides represented our community well. Everything was very, very civil, mm-hmm. I guess you could say, and it came off real well. So,
and this is the first year of Liberty Fest in Hampton.
Yeah. Yep.
Why did you feel the need to start Liberty Fest and celebrate it in a grander way than it has been in past years?
Well, basically, it to me, in my eyes, and in the eyes of people who feel the same way as I do about the Constitution, it's like we feel like Constitution Day should be every bit as celebrated as the 4th of July. It's hard for people of our ideology to separate those two documents. You know, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution to us kind of go hand in hand.
People of your ideology, you're saying libertarians.
I guess you could say I wouldn't. I'm a libertarian leaning individual, but people mm-hmm. of our ideology who are more strict constitutionalists. And view the document in a more strict manner. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this question, yeah. Mayor Dietz. What aspects of our Constitution do you think that we as 21st century citizens of this country need most to be reminded of?
Well, I think one of the things that previous guest hit on was, he talked about this idea of a living document and the fact that the founders allowed for an amendment process. The problem is there are so many laws that go into effect, there are so many court decisions that are made that become law without an amendment process ever taking place. And
but not to our Constitution.
Right.
So our
right.
Constitution, they put it, wouldn't you agree, they put a pretty high hurdle in front of anyone who wants to change the Constitution.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's by design.
Right. So, it was made. The founding fathers did say we know this will be changed.
And yeah, absolutely.
And so the idea, and let me get David Wendell back into this as a historian here. The thinking, am I correct, David Wendell? And the thinking is, how high do you put that bar so that we have an amendment only when? What?
Well, the Constitution lays out a tripartite government. That means we have executive, judicial, and legislative. And it makes very clear that the legislative branch of the government is the one who holds the responsibilities to make laws. Then, of course, there is, if necessary, should that law be contested, a court system through which that law can proceed in order to determine whether it matches the prescripts of the Constitution or not. So, therefore, I feel there is a process of checks and balances to maintain this.
Okay. Sean Dietz, Mayor Dietz, tell me, is this event, Liberty Fest in Hampton, a political, having a political agenda in this election year?
Absolutely not. One of the things that I was asked early on was this going to be a campaign event? And there are some political figures who will be speaking on Saturday, but these are people who hold a strict and honest view of the Constitution. What we're trying to do is we're trying to promote the document.
Yeah.
My specific answer when I was asked that question was, this going to be a political event or promoting any kind of political agenda mm-hmm. a few months back was, you're not going to see anybody carrying Mitt Romney or Barack Obama signs at this event.
Right. Your wording strict and honest interpretation of the Constitution makes me, of course, there would be a wide variance in what any
Absolutely.
Number of people would agree as an interpretation, from the strict
right.
constructionalists all the way to the people who say this is a living document. So you're saying everyone has a strict and honest, or not?
Absolutely. I mean, I talk to people all the time who have a different opinion than I do of what the Constitution means. I'm someone who researches and tries to look for what the original intent was. I'll go back. I'll try to find original sources as much as possible and read the founders' words themselves mm-hmm. so that I can gain a better understanding of what was meant, for instance, by, general welfare clause or something like that. But one of the things that's important, I think, for people to understand is myself, along with some of the people that have helped me organize this event, is we're not seeking for people to agree with us issue by issue. All we're looking for is for people to celebrate the document that gives us the freedom to be able to have an event like this and to be able to have these discussions.
Okay. Let me ask a question of you, Mayor Dietz, that I asked of David Wendell. What do you suppose our founding fathers would make of the discussion now, 225 years later, the points, the contentious points that touch upon our Constitution that we find in the public sphere today?
Well, I think a couple of things. One, I think from if they were to step back and take a more mental point of view from it, or a mental stance on it, they might say, watch the rhetoric, and be friendly with each other, be respectful, and understand each other's ideas. On the other side of that, we have evidence from history that they weren't like that at all when they were campaigning. It's well known, I think, the divisiveness that existed between Jefferson and Adams, and some of the fights that they had. I mean, they had a very bitter rivalry after a long time friendship. But what I think we need to kind of take away from the founders is this idea that, as Franklin said, that, as he got older, he started to understand that, maybe I'm not always right, and maybe it's okay for me to listen to somebody else's opinion. And that's all I think we're looking for is, not even so much on the side of, putting two sides together and coming up with a compromise so much as it is just be respectful and be willing to listen to the other side.
We have less than – Mayor Dietz, I'm sorry to interrupt. We have less than a minute. I wanted to have David Wendell chime in with the last comment, perhaps a reaction or something we haven't mentioned to –
Well, since you've been specifically mentioned the libertarian leanings of the mayor, I'm curious, Mr. Mayor, had you been at the Constitutional Convention back in 1787, would you have supported the Constitution without the promise of a Bill of Rights?
That's an interesting question. I think with the want for that, for the Bill of Rights, I think I could have supported it, as Franklin said, with its imperfections, because I think at the time of the Constitutional Convention, I think there was that feeling that needed to happen, and I think the Constitution allowed for that to take place. So I think there was enough there to support that.
Mayor Sean Dietz, we have to say goodbye. Mayor of Hampton, Iowa, congratulations on your inaugural Liberty Fest, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Iowa historian David Wendell, thank you for talking a relatively short time about this great document.
Very short time. Need to come back.
We do need to have you back. David Wendell, thank you very much. We'd love to have you back in the future. Thank you for coming in today.
You're welcome.
Coming up on River to River, when we return after a short break, we'll talk about branding. And I'm not talking cattle, folks. We'll find out why Simpson College just won the Battle of the Brands. That's when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back of more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So good to have you with us over the noon out here on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Simpson College in Indianola has been declared champion of Lessing Flynn Advertising's Battle of the Brands by winning this 2012 event. Simpson College's charity of choice, Children and Family Urban Ministries, will receive $5,000 worth of marketing support from Lessing Flynn. Join us to explain what in the world a Battle of the Brands is and how Simpson came out on top. Josh Fleming is in our Des Moines studio. He's Digital Strategy Director for Lessing Flynn. Josh, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben, and thanks for having me.
This is the third year of this event, this contest. What is it?
Well, what we wanted to do was give brands in Iowa a platform to be able to kind of rally brand advocates and give them a floor, if you will, to have people kind of pump their chest out and say, you know, I'm a fan of this brand or I like this brand. Through so much of the work that we do with our clients and the people we meet, a lot of them, social media is very new. And so as they use Facebook, as they use Twitter, they don't really know what to say. And this contest really gives them the ability to kind of highlight why they're a strong brand in Iowa and why so many people support them.
Okay, so I understand this year 65 brands competing. And over what length of time?
We do this over a four-week period. It's similar in format to the March Madness brackets, okay, if you will. And the way the voting is determined is based on fans voting. So we have no decision in the matter at Lessing Flynn. We don't decide who wins or who moves on.
There are no judges.
There are no judges except for the community at large and the people that support the brands. And what we found really is that the brands that participate the most and really try to engage their fans and their advocates tend to do better.
Mm-hmm. How does this how does this different than just someone trying to get in to up their brand? I know Hy-Vee, A&E Dairy. How does it distinguish itself from just sort of a wrestling around trying to get a little more publicity for your brand?
Well, there's a lot of different strategies that have gone into place for all the brands that have won and that have been in this promotion. But what really is happening is we're finding that the people that are the strongest in terms of Facebook followers, Twitter followers, or you know people with strong email lists, or just overall strong brands in general, tend to do better than those that aren't as highly engaged.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Josh Fleming, how do you define branding for someone who just doesn't intersect with this in their life at all, or think they don't, because we consume things all the time, don't we?
Right, absolutely. Well, I think branding has changed quite a bit. I think, you know, 10 to 15 years ago, a brand was what people considered to be a logo or what the company said their brand was or their tagline was. And now it's evolved to a little bit of that, but mostly it's that gut feeling or that experience you get when I say the name Hy-Vee or Iowa State Fair or Simpson College. You have a specific feeling in your mind and in your heart as to what that is, and that's truly what the brand is. And so what we're finding is that, you know, brands can kind of steer and guide consumers in terms of what they should try to have them think of the brand, but ultimately it's the consumer's opinion and their feelings about a company, a mark, a tagline that really defines what the brand is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go back to this year's competition, the blow-by-blow account from the sidelines. I understand in the second part of the competition, Simpson College, the eventual champion this year, was pitted against Central College, Central College in Pella, and that really upped the interest, didn't it?
It really did, and we tried to, in these brackets, when we put them together, we picked the 65 brands that we think are most deserving, and having an Iowa tie and being an Iowa-based ad agency helps with that, but we like to put matchups in the first round or second round, potentially, that are going to drive some interest in the contest. And certainly putting Central and Simpson in a position to play each other in the second round was by design. Mm-hmm. I think Simpson surprised a lot of people by winning the whole thing. But I think if you kind of look back at what they did through some of their marketing efforts, it makes a lot of sense. And people are really loyal and faithful to that school. Mm-hmm. But, as Jill Johnson at Simpson shared with us, when the Central College matchup came up, it was like the hottest thing on their campus down there is we have to beat Simpson College. It's, you know, if we had Iowa State versus each other, it might have been the same sort of thing. But, you know, I think these smaller schools feel that rivalry even more so.
How would you describe the difference in branding between Simpson and Central College in this matchup?
You know, I think I don't know that I can really answer the question specifically to the difference in branding. I would think that a lot of it is based on effort. I know that Simpson just went after it, full guns blaring, if you will.
With social media.
With social media, with their alumni list, with their staff list, their student email list. You know, we've got a couple Simpson alums in our office, and they were getting, you know, hit from multiple sides from Simpson in terms of, hey, go support our brand. And for the most part, the response was overwhelmingly positive, and Simpson really didn't have a close match throughout the entire event because they were really publicizing this a lot. So combination of being a strong brand and at the same time utilizing your marketing resources to pull off a victory.
Okay, so you have to have the winning content, and then you have to distribute it. You have to get the word out. You have to raise awareness.
Absolutely.
That's what I'm hearing from you.
Absolutely. You know, there's going to be those strong brands that are always there. You know, the Iowa State Fair seems to be in the Final Four every single year, and, you know, they do a good job of tweeting it out and putting it on Facebook. But it's one of those things where I think the harder you work to rally your brand advocates, the better you're going to fare in the competition.
Now, the championships match saw Simpson College, after its win over Central College, triumph over Anderson Erickson Dairy. How would you characterize that final face-off?
Well, you know, AE Dairy is the stuff of legends, right? I mean, those guys make ridiculously great dip and milk and yogurt. And I hear stories of people like that come back to Iowa and specifically bring AE Dairy home with them out of state because it's so good. And I know that they're a very strong brand as well. AE Dairy actually has a social media firm in Texas that contacted us to help them understand more about the promotion and how they could promote themselves. So AE Dairy did a nice job to make it as far as that as they did, and actually utilized an agency in Texas to help them along the way.
Mm-hmm. Past being declared champion, what does winning this battle do for a competitor? What does it do for Simpson College in this case, past wearing this badge? Or do they get a medal, a badge, a trophy? What do they get?
Yeah. The first 2 years we gave away a ridiculous trophy, which was a candlestick with a boxing glove on the top. Really, you know, we thought if we tried to make a trophy, you know, we'd have a hard time making it look too awesome. So we went kind of with a fun, what would an ad agency do for a trophy sort of route. But this third year, the trophy or what you actually won was this donation to your charity of choice. So in the final four brands that were remaining, we featured some information and links out to the charities that these final four brands were playing for. Mm-hmm. And I think there was some support from some of these charities as well to, for example, say, you know, go vote for Simpson College because it'll help our charity, Children and Family Urban Ministries. Right. I'm not sure how much of that went on, but, you know, these charities stand to gain.
Right, and of course, media exposure, as we're giving Simpson College today, doesn't hurt either. Josh Fleming is with us, Digital Strategy Director for Lessing Flynn. We're talking about this year's 2012 Battle of the Brands. Simpson College came out on top. It's the third year of this contest. I want to introduce into our conversation Lynn Mondernach. She is the co-founder, president, and so-called brand arsonist. Watch out for Mindfire Communications in Cedar Rapids and LeClaire. Welcome back to our program, Lynn.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
You've been listening to our conversation. I want to get your take, because this branding idea is something that is perhaps not easily definable for, especially for people outside of advertising. How would you describe it to people?
You know, I describe it very similarly to the way Josh did. It's really something that lives in the hearts and minds of consumers. From a company perspective, lots of companies are out there trying to figure out how to better brand themselves to be more effective in the marketplace. But ultimately, what's most important is that it's not what the company says the brand is. It's what the consumers say that brand is. They get to decide.
Right. And so the interesting part about it, or one of the interesting part about it, seems to me that you can have a brand, but you as the institution or the company, you're not entirely in control of that, are you?
And that scares the heck out of a lot of companies. That's absolutely true. There are certainly things that you can do to influence your brand, but right, you can't totally control it. And in these days of social media, it's actually something that makes a lot of CEOs very stressed, because they want to be able to control that message. That's the way they've been successful in the past. And transitioning to a world where the consumers have a lot more say in how that brand is expressed is a very frightening spot for a lot of marketers and CEOs.
Okay, but tell me, basic elements, what makes a successful brand, Lynn?
A successful brand is a brand that is consistently communicated. It's authentic. It's something that rings true to the consumer. And it's something that's relevant to the consumer. They have to care about what this brand is in order for it to be a successful brand.
Okay. How do you know when branding is working? Or do you know that from the get-go? Do you have ideas or see ideas out there and you say, there is no way this will fail?
A successful brand works across all platforms. It works in many different ways. It works in terms of Well, the ultimate gauge for a successful brand is that it contributes to the bottom line. There's a lot of research out there that indicates that the brands that are most successful in terms of articulating authentically who they are and consistently demonstrating it actually see the difference in the bottom line. There's revenue that's attached to a strong brand.
Who do you put up on the pinnacle of successful branding?
Well, today's a great day to talk about Apple with the new iPhone out there.
Yeah.
Apple has a very powerful brand. It's practically a cult-like religion for a lot of people. So there are a lot of people who find that to be an extremely consistent, authentic, and relevant brand.
Dissect that a little bit more, though. What makes Apple glow in most people's eyes and hearts and consumers just go for that brand?
You know, it's hard to articulate exactly what it is because when you look at the actual facts in terms of how the Apple products compare to other products, they don't win on all of those points. So it's not just about the product. It's about the brand. It's how this brand is perceived, how it makes people feel, how they feel having an Apple product reflects on who they are. And so there are a lot of intangibles that are tied into it. It's not just the facts and the rational part of this product.
Josh Fleming of Lessing Flynn, I wonder, this is the third year of the contest, the battle of the brands for the past 3 years. What can you say about the keys to winning and the keys in your agency for successful branding?
Yeah, I think the keys to winning are multiple. And, you know, what really sets people up is going after their clients or their prospects or the people that adore them and talking to them and having open, honest conversations on some of their social platforms now, whether or not they're in the battle of the brands or not. This is something that should be done by every company. I could make an argument that, you know, even a waste management company should be heavily involved in social media if the content is right, the message is right, and it's going to the right audience. So, you know, these companies really need to get out there and start having these dialogues and start having these conversations as opposed to waiting for something like the battle of the brands to kind of prompt them to do so. Mm-hmm. We've found that the ones that have been set up and have already been having open conversations with their clients and, you know, to Lynn's point about, you know, being authentic and honest and transparent and, you know, trying to have some influence, but putting out good content and being receptive to what your clients are demanding really is the recipe for success on all social platforms as it pertains to branding.
You held out Apple, Lynn, as a very successful branding example. Well, what about the other side? Where is a name for me what you would put as an epic failure of branding?
I think that the Gap logo change that happened, I think it was last year, they just made some would say a somewhat random change to their logo with a lot of communication wrapped around it. And that was one of those where they threw it out there and then they kind of backed up. Another example is one from a number of years ago. It was United Airlines who spent a lot of money on a campaign called United Rising. And the focus of the campaign was that the customer service was going to be so much better, that this was going to be a better experience for travelers. But the gap that they had was that they hadn't really talked to their employees about it. They really hadn't put additional training behind those ideas. And so expectations were raised. People were expecting a different experience when they interacted with United Airlines. And there was a great campaign that told them that their expectations could be higher, could be rising.
Right.
But the reality did not bear that out. And what that really brings us to is how important the internal component is for branding. When people think of branding, a lot of times they're thinking about the advertising and the marketing and the social media that they see outside of the organization. But that authentic part of that brand is what happens inside the organization. How prepared are your employees to deliver on the promise that you are making to your consumers?
Right. It sounds exactly like a contract. If you're going to hold this up and say, I will do this if you give me your business, and that doesn't come through, there can be a harsh reaction to that.
Absolutely. In fact, you're damaging your brand you're better off not to make that promise at all than to make that promise and not be prepared to keep it.
How do we know if an institution, some entity, a business or institution needs a rebranding? What does that mean anyway, Lynn?
You know, there are a lot of companies that when they start feeling pain in some way or another, they think, well, maybe what we need to do is rebrand ourselves. So typically there's some level of pain that precedes the decision to move forward with a rebranding.
Dropping sales, dropping enrollment, that type of thing.
Increased competition, yes. Mm-hmm. It's usually financial in some way. And so rebranding gives you an opportunity to step back and really look at what's going on in your marketplace. When I work with companies for branding, the very first step is always research. We take a look at what's the perception of the brand from the perspective of the customers. What about the potential customers? What about the previous customers? And we really need to spend some time talking to the employees about what they see as the brand and what does this company do well mm-hmm. and what do we not do that well? And what's the experience of interacting with this company?
It sounds to me like when you have clients and they invite you into their inner circle to discuss possible rebranding with your company, Mindfire Communications, that they don't necessarily know what's involved with what they're wanting.
Sometimes they don't. Companies are getting a lot more savvy. Mm-hmm. It's something that it's hard to ignore branding. It's out there, and it's difficult to not have any idea what it's about anymore. But they understand that it can make a difference in their bottom line. It can make a difference in their competitive capability. It allows them to have hold a perception in the minds of their consumers to warm up that potential sale.
Mm-hmm. As we mentioned earlier, one of the interesting things about branding is you, if it's your brand, you don't necessarily have control of it. Things can happen in the news to your brand. And I wonder if I can think the most catastrophic example of a brand being damaged in the recent times, and because we're talking about institutions of higher learning, I'm going to say Penn State.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever would you be able to do with that brand right now in the foreseeable future, Lynn?
That was an incredibly challenging brand issue. I think for that particular brand catastrophe, you know, you can't fix that with proactive communication. You can't fix that with advertising or marketing. That was something that had moved into the realm of the law, and something that when there's that much damage and emotional damage to a brand, sometimes the best thing to do is just kind of back away, which is counterintuitive because in a lot of situations, those branding catastrophes are fueled by what's happening online. Mm-hmm. And a company needs to be very proactive to get in front of that and to be responsive and to not just let it play out without them being part of that conversation. But the Penn State situation was one where there wasn't much they could say that could make that situation better.
Josh Fleming, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think crisis communication planning really can help companies, especially through public relations professionals that know how to do that sort of thing. But there's no way ever I would want to work on the Penn State business. I mean, that's just one of those you can't get out of, and it was just so offensive and so sad for so many people involved. Back to real quick on some of Lynn's thoughts with brand fails. I saw a recent opportunity to talk about this. Samsung ran a social media contest saying which item would you most like to bring to a deserted island? And everybody answered Apple, Apple iPhones, Apple products. And so it just totally backfired in their face. And I wanted to make sure I shared that because it was, as you said, Ben, an epic fail.
I wonder, we have different types of businesses, corporations, schools, universities, nonprofit organizations. Lynn, what difference does it make that the type of entity that we're talking about, does that matter?
Not really, because it's ultimately about the consumer. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, it is about individuals who are making decisions about where they're going to put their money. And as they make those decisions, it's not purely a financial transaction. And as social media gives us the opportunity to engage more with the brands that we're interested in, to more publicly display with our likes on Facebook or whatever that might be, our allegiance to a particular brand, it continues to expand in that way. There are just more opportunities for consumers to drive that brand.
Mm-hmm. And finally, we have about a minute left. Back to you, Josh Fleming in Des Moines. When we talk about your event, this is the third year running Battle of the Brands. Describe how this contest has grown in 3 years.
It really kind of grew from an idea where we saw a bracket of the worst brands in the world, which included places like Microsoft and Walmart. And the president of the agency, Tom Flynn, challenged me. He said, Josh, how can we make something positive out of this? So we didn't really think it would take on like it did, but I think the combination of Iowa and especially Des Moines having such a strong Twitter community really propelled it. These being Iowa brands really helped it out. Prior winners, the first year was the Iowa Clinic, and then the second year was the Principal Financial Group. Both strong, great brands here, I think really kind of helped elevate this. And then adding a charity aspect to it this year, which we plan to do in future years, I think we'll keep this thing moving along strongly. And we do have some ideas on how to expand it and grow it and kind of change it so that it doesn't become the same thing every year.
Josh Fleming, Digital Strategy Director for Lessing Flynn, thank you for joining us in Des Moines.
Thank you for having me. And Lynn is a very smart lady. I enjoyed everything that she said. I was almost kind of clapping over here.
And I feel the same, Josh.
Amen.
Lynn Mondernach is the co-founder, president, and brand arsonist for Mindfire Communications in Cedar Rapids. And to Claire, Lynn, always a pleasure to have you on our program.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Dennis Reese, executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, Jeff Schmidt. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.